Hey there, it's Chris Bentley, host of Here and Now Anytime. Let me ask you a quick favor. It's easy, but important to me and everyone who works on this show. If you like that we're here every afternoon, bringing you fresh perspectives and insightful conversations on the big stories of the day, take 5 seconds and follow Here and Now Anytime, wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. And if you want to make us really happy and help other people find this show, leave us a good review. It really helps. And thanks. Now here's the show.
Either you prepare or you die in the process. And so many persons decided to go batten down the hatches, empty the supermarkets.
People in St. Vincent and the Grenadines are no strangers to hurricanes, but no one was prepared for a storm this strong, this early in the year. It's Tuesday, July 2nd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, would Watergate have been legal under the Supreme Court's new rule on presidential immunity? And we'll mark 60 years since the Civil Rights Act with Elaine Lee Turner. She and her sister were named the most arrested civil rights family in America.
We would picket the department stores that did not hire blacks as cashiers because that was just for the whites, of course.
Changing history through protest, coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, Hurricane Beryl is a very weird storm. It's the earliest Category 5 on record in the Atlantic. It's the strongest storm to make landfall in this particular part of the Caribbean, and it's one of the fiercest storms ever recorded in June. The small nation of St. Vincent and the Grenadines felt Beryl's fury firsthand. The country's prime minister, Ralph Gonsalves, spoke in a press conference late yesterday.
Hurricane Beryl has come and has gone. And it has left in its wake immense destruction across our nation at this hour.
Ernesto Cook is a journalist and editor of the national paper, the St. Vincent Times. He's been sheltering in place in the capital, Kingstown. And this morning, he told Peter O'Dowd what it was like to ride out the storm.
It was scary. It was really an ominous situation. But we did survive. No structural damage at all to our house. But there were neighbors around us who had severe damage.
And there are some islands, I understand, that were just leveled. Union Island, according to your reporting, 90% of the houses destroyed or damaged. What does that mean for basic services like water, power, radio communication, hospitals?
So Union Island, 90% of the housing infrastructure on the island, yes, was decimated, which means hospitals were damaged. Power grid is completely knocked out. The airport severely damaged, which means no flights are in and out of the island. The communication system, the towers, they were all destroyed. So that island basically is off the grid, so to speak. Other Grenadine islands as well, including the rich and famous Canawan Island, that has extensive damage, and a few others in between.
Do you know yet if anyone has been hurt?
So we had one death on the island of Bekwe, which is the largest Grenadine island. That's the only death that has been reported so far by the police and the authorities on the island.
Well, listen, you're in the Caribbean. It's not uncommon for there to be hurricanes where you live, but one of this size was historically early, and I wonder if that made it more challenging to prepare for this storm.
Absolute challenge, because the islanders here would tell you that, look, it's not going to come here. It's going north, so we're not preparing for anything. By Friday evening, it had become clear that either you prepare or you die in the process. And so many persons decided to go batten down the hatches, empty the supermarkets, the gas stations. They were just literally a buzz within activity on the island. The houses, many of them could not withstand the Category 4 hurricane. You're talking about 140 miles per hour slamming into an island. And wow. The houses on the mainland, St. Vincent, we're looking at about $40 million to deal with the devastating effects.
After this storm, your Prime Minister, Ralph Gonsalves, had some pretty harsh words for rich countries that have contributed to climate change. He said that they're doing a lot of talking about this problem, but they haven't done much to help small island countries like yours that suffer the brunt of the impact of a hotter climate. Is that a common feeling in St. Vincent and the Grenadines, especially now after this hurricane?
It is a common feeling, widespread among the population, has been for a while, even before this hurricane. We've talked a lot about climate change in these small parts, and we keep saying, look, we don't contribute. We hardly contribute anything at all, if anything at all, to this situation. Yet we have to fork out all of the money to deal with all of the issues that come about because of climate change, and the rich countries promise, and yet do not deliver.
Ernesto Cook is the editor of the St. Vincent Times. He's in Kingstown. Ernesto, thank you, and we wish you and your neighbors the best of luck as you recover from this storm.
Thanks, I'd appreciate for having me.
Coming up next, democracy. How's it doing? After the break, Peter and Celeste Headley have two conversations tying together some threads in what's been a whirlwind of political news. We've got historical context for yesterday's Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity and how that expansion of presidential power ups the stakes even more for Democrats who are in panic mode after Biden's shaky performance at the debate last week. All that when we return.
Last night, President Biden forcefully criticized yesterday's landmark ruling from the conservative-leaning Supreme Court, giving former presidents broad immunity from prosecution for official actions taken while in office.
I know I will respect the limits of the presidential powers I have for 3.5 years, but any president, including Donald Trump, will now be free to ignore the law.
Biden used a teleprompter. He did not respond to shouted questions about his poor debate performance last week, which has ignited calls for him to bow out of the race. And before those remarks, aides told anxious donors that Biden's campaign saw a surge of donations after the debate. Andrew Desiderio is a senior congressional reporter for Punchbowl News, and he's following developments in this story. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the Biden campaign wants to make protecting democracy a focal point of this race. Did the president get new fodder for that argument after yesterday's immunity ruling from the Supreme Court?
Well, look, the president and his team are obviously trying to shift to the issues, right, the substance, and deflect these questions about his mental fitness, his mental acuity, amid all of those legitimate questions about it after the debate last week. And you're seeing that yes, while that is sort of a way for the president to sort of push back against those claims, as you mentioned in your lead-in, that was done with a teleprompter, right? Which is very different than responding to questions sort of organically and off the cuff, which is why you're seeing many of his allies now promise that the president is going to be doing more of these sort of more candid interviews with journalists and, you know, taking questions from voters at town halls. For example, we have yet to see that, and we have yet to get some sort of schedule of how that might work. But, you know, the president last night, as you mentioned, did not respond to shouted questions from reporters. And I think a lot of the president's allies were looking for him to sort of show that he can, you know, comport himself to those off-the-cuff moments where he doesn't know what's coming.
And meanwhile, he has been very clear, and so have his aides, that he's going to stay in this race. But where exactly do the big money Democratic donors stand right now? And if the president loses them, does it become increasingly difficult for Biden?
Yeah, it becomes that much harder. You're already seeing a lot of Democrats behind closed doors and private circles, especially the donors as well, trying to shift the focus to keeping the House of Representatives, or rather flipping the House of Representatives to a Democratic majority, because increasingly Democrats see that as their only winnable option this November, because the Senate is very likely to go towards the Republicans. And with the race for the White House now in doubt, the House would be the only real firewall against a Republican trifecta here in Washington, they would be able to really successfully prevent a lot of what Republicans would try to do next year under a potential Donald Trump presidency. And there's a lot of thinking right now, a lot of chatter in Democratic circles, especially among donors, as I mentioned, that they should shift their focus to the House of Representatives right now, because that is their best sort of firewall against all of this.
Yeah. You say those conversations were happening in private, but Illinois Congressman Democrat Mike Quigley said it out loud to CNN this morning. Here he is talking about the president's debate performance.
We have to be honest with ourselves that it wasn't just a horrible night, but I won't go beyond that. I just want him to appreciate at this time just how much it impacts not just his race, but all the other races coming in November.
How likely is it the Democrats could win the House?
It's very likely. Look, they're only five seats away from getting the majority, right? And that would mean netting five seats, obviously. So it's a very, very close contest. It was already expected to be close. And, you know, what we're seeing from people like Mike Quigley is a delicate balance, right? A recognition that President Biden has done a lot for the Democratic Party. They appreciate everything he's done while he's been in office. But they're really trying to nudge him or, you know, walk up to the line without crossing it in terms of suggesting to him, hey, maybe you should consider, you know, the fact that you might be dragging the rest of us down as we try to prevent what could be a GOP trifecta in Washington next year.
Meanwhile, a lot of this is speculation. We don't know how the debate is going to affect the presidential campaign or the vote in November, but it seems to be that the Biden camp is waiting for new post-debate poll numbers that would give us some kind of sense. Is that going to be a big factor in deciding where to go next?
Yeah, that's going to be a huge factor, and I think that's what a lot of members of Congress on the Democratic side of the aisle are waiting for at this point, right? It's one thing to see these flash polls, these push polls immediately after the debate, which show people's immediate reactions. But, you know, once you get polling data that shows whether those concerns about President Biden's age have really set in among the electorate, that's going to be really determinative for Democrats, especially, as I mentioned before, who are running in these tight races for House and Senate, who are worried that the president could be sort of dragging them down and you know, preventing Democrats from taking back the House of Representatives, which, again, is a major priority now.
Andrew Desiderio is a senior congressional reporter for Punchbowl News. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Watergate, Iran-Contra, the Teapot Dome. Just how protected would presidents have been from the fallout of these political scandals, according to the Supreme Court's latest decision that gives presidents broad immunity for official acts? That ruling effectively cleared former President Trump from the January 6th case against him, and it fits into a steady march toward greater and greater presidential power. Julian Zelizer is back with us. He's a professor of history and public policy at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Hi, nice to be with you.
So you have written often about the imperial presidency. How much authority does this new Supreme Court ruling give to presidents?
Well, I think it's a significant expansion. First, it legitimates the idea that there's many things a president can do where they do have immunity from some sort of criminal accusation and trial. And then more importantly, it creates a gray area that is a little broader than simply the obvious actions of a president. And I think that gray area is going to be where the expansion takes place. Future presidents will try to capitalize on that, and they'll use that sometimes to take actions that cross the line, knowing that there's not much that can be done other than a very lengthy court process at some point.
So what does that mean in terms of the gray area? Would Watergate have been legal under this ruling, at least for Nixon?
I think a lot of the big scandals, Richard Nixon and Watergate, Ronald Reagan and Iran-Contra, and maybe even former President Trump's you know, scandals with both impeachments, there might be a lot more room for all of those presidents to have claimed that what they did was part of what they were doing as president. And according to the Supreme Court ruling, there can't be a crime committed because of that. And it goes back to, you know, Richard Nixon, who said famously after his presidency, that if a president did something, and I'm paraphrasing, it can't be illegal. I think the court legitimated that, and that would have wiped away many of the scandals. It's possible to admit and see how Watergate might never have unfolded the way it did if this court ruling had been in place.
So what does this do to the separation of powers that were created by the Constitution's framers? How does this compare with the very careful steps they took to create checks and balances?
Well, it erodes the separation of powers. We've seen this already with impeachment, in that in our age of polarization, it's become much harder to move forward with impeachment than it already was. And we saw that with both of the impeachments against Trump. And now in the realm of the law, it's become more difficult to do what Nixon feared after he finished his presidency, to take a legal action against a president for what they had done. It doesn't eliminate the balance of powers. Courts still have power, Congress still has power, but it certainly weakens it significantly, and it creates incentives for future presidents to act very aggressively if they don't want to follow internal guardrails.
The powers of the presidents seem to have steadily grown since George Washington. Can you tell us about what the big inflection points were, maybe FDR or Lincoln and wartime powers?
Yeah, I think between Teddy Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson in the 20th century, because of war and America being more engaged in the world and more issues and policies taking place here in the U.S., we saw an expansion of the executive branch, we saw powers being given to the president, and the president just becoming a bigger role in American life. This all culminates with Watergate and Arthur Schlesinger calling this the imperial presidency. There was some retrenchment in the 1970s after Watergate, but now we've seen an expansion. We've seen many conservatives embrace a theory of the unitary executive where the president is almost above the power of anyone, any kind of oversight, and that's been institutionalized in the law. And after 9/11, we saw a vast expansion of the national security powers of the president. So that's kind of a thumbnail history, and I do think this court decision, while it doesn't give total immunity to the president, gives enough that it will be one stage in this long history where presidents become more powerful than the founders originally imagined.
So we just have about a minute left here. Does this Supreme Court ruling mean that a president could stage a coup or an insurrection, and there is absolutely nothing the American legal system could do about it?
We're closer to that. There's still room for the legal system to do something. That's the gray area. It's more difficult, but the courts have room to see, did a president go into the outer perimeters? And of course, Congress still has the impeachment power. It's about the willingness to use it. And finally, voters still have the power to decide who gets to be in office. All of that is still part of the balance that can be achieved.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public policy at Princeton University. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
We're looking for some help for a political story that we're working on. This one is for my fellow millennials. What's motivating your vote this election year? And how have your politics changed over time? Tell us, and we might put your thoughts on this podcast or on the radio. Go to hereandnow.org/millennials and leave us a voice message. You can record with your phone right from that page. hereandnow.org/millennials. Here is H-E-R-E, by the way. And since I just misspelled it myself, millennials has two L's and two N's. And thanks. Looking forward to hearing your stories. We've got one more conversation for you today. After the break, Peter speaks with one of the members of the most arrested family of the civil rights era, how her protests helped change history when we return. Sixty years ago today, with the stroke of a pen, President Lyndon B. Johnson made history.
This Civil Rights Act is a challenge to all of us. to go to work in our communities and our states, in our homes and in our hearts, to eliminate the last vestiges of injustice in our beloved country.
The Civil Rights Act is considered one of the most important pieces of legislation ever to become law in this country. It made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And it never would have been possible without thousands of Black activists who bravely protested through the civil rights movement of the 1960s. One of those activists was Elaine Lee Turner. She and her sisters attended marches and sit-ins at libraries and lunch counters. Together, they were arrested nearly 20 times in their pursuit of equality. And on this anniversary, she joined us from Memphis for this conversation with Peter O'Dowd.
We've had the Civil Rights Act for 60 years now. It has certainly not solved all our country's problems, but it's nonetheless historic. How are you reflecting on this anniversary today? How are you feeling?
I think that it's wonderful that changes were legalized by the president, but there has been a regression over the last 60 years. And so I do reflect on it with some disappointment because so many rights are being denied even today in 2024. Yeah.
I do want to ask you about today, but first, if we could just go back for a moment, because for those who grew up after the Civil Rights era, this probably feels like ancient history. You and your sisters were there. You were high school and college students when you started marching and protesting. Take us back to that time, what it was like that got you motivated to do something.
Well, living with segregation is a constant I guess you should say, a cloud over your existence, over your weight of life. But that was the law, and we had to abide by those laws. So we couldn't just walk up into a white school and register. That was just would have been unheard of during that time. So we would have to get the city bus to travel to our school at our parents' expense every day, going back and forth. And so it was costly. It was demeaning. And so when we had the opportunity to make some changes, it was a given that we would be a part of making those changes.
And you were there for some of the biggest moments of the civil rights movement. You attended the 1966 March Against Fear, which was led by James Meredith. This is the first African-American to enroll at the University of Mississippi. The march was from Memphis to Jackson. And here's some sound of Meredith talking about it.
The surest way to power is through the vote. And it is for this reason that I have decided to use all of my spare time trying to encourage Negroes particularly, but all people who are unregistered in this country, to register and vote. And that is the purpose of this march today.
As you know, while he was walking, Meredith was shot, and several civil rights activists, including Martin Luther King Jr., had to turn up to finish the march for him. What do you remember from that day?
When we heard that he had been shot down, of course, we were all shocked with that. But knowing what the South was like, then it was not uncommon. And so when Dr. King called for others to come and march into Jackson, Mississippi, we knew that we had to be a part of that.
Well, you also must have known that it could have been you that was seriously harmed or killed by a white person who was enraged by the idea that you and your sister should have the same rights as they did. Were you ever afraid? Did that limit what you did when you went out onto the streets?
No. James Meredith being shot in no way limited what I was committed to do and the rest of my family. It made us more determined to be a part of making changes. In 1966, that Meredith, Mississippi March Against Fear, We had been in the struggle for 6 years already, with marching and sitting in and getting arrested and picketing and whatever it took. So in 1966, I suppose we were veterans, so we just joined right in. That was what we were supposed to do, to erase all vestiges of discrimination and segregation. Some laws had been changed as a result of our activism, and so we felt that this was just another battlefront, and we had to be right there on the front lines doing our part to make those changes.
And as you know as well as anyone, the Civil Rights Act did not eliminate racism in this country. I mean, Black Americans continue to face discrimination in pretty much all aspects of our society. What is your message to young people who are just entering this fight? What would you tell them?
I would tell young people it's a continuation of the struggles of our ancestors, from slavery, being kidnapped from their, as far as African Americans, from their motherland, going through the horrors of slavery, the Jim Crow era, and all of that that followed. Someone made some sacrifices. Someone stood up and challenged the injustices in this country. So for today, young people, when they see injustices, they need to speak up. They need to stand up. They need to protest and demand that the United States live up to its creed that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and that's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And you cannot do that with all these restrictive laws because of race. So their job is to continue that struggle until the Constitution does mean everybody is created equal and they are in, have certain rights. The right to vote is one of those. The right to register to vote and be a part of the system is supposed to be a right of all American citizens, but it still is not. And so it's going to take this next generation, and hopefully not the next generation that have to keep it going, but I'm sure that that's what's going to happen, because there will be those who would still try to restrict those rights.
Elaine Lee Turner, civil rights activist in Memphis on this, the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act, still as relevant today as it was many years ago. Elaine, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
You are welcome.
That's our show. Here and Now Anytime comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian, Lynn Menegon, James Mastro Marino, and Koyani Saxena. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Ahmad Daman, Micaela Rodriguez, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical direction from Caleb Green. Our theme music is by Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow.